This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, the Pope says he's deeply sorry. Is that enough? And fashion shows in Madrid ban models who are too skinny, but France won't follow. Joining us today from our New York bureau are Robert George, editorial writer at the New York Post. Marcelo Suarez Orozco is professor of globalization and education at New York University. He's at member station WLIU in Southampton, New York. And Callie Crossley, social cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press in Boston, is at member station WGBH in Boston, Massachusetts. Thank you all for joining us. So let's talk a little bit more about this issue of Pope Benedict. Criticism from Iran. Many people who are in the Mideast who are Christian are feeling the heat for Pope Benedict's remarks, saying that actually quoting a previous Christian who said that Islam spread through intimidation, terror, and violence. Now, this is arguably the second apology we've heard from the Pope on this issue. Marcelo, is that enough?
Well, that's the question. In a way, there are really two competing interpretations or hypotheses here. One is that the papacy is in transition, that the Holy Father writes his own speeches, that they didn't really vet the speech properly, they didn't really examine it closely. When you speak for a billion plus Catholics, every word you say will be listened to very, very carefully. The second interpretation is that he really meant to start a conversation on the issue of the relationship between religion and violence, and that this was really an invitation to a broad discussion that clearly backfired.
Well, you know, Robert, there's an invitation and then there's an invitation. Like if someone, you know, clocks you on the back of your head, that could be an invitation to fight as opposed to an invitation to a conversation. How do you think this invitation was offered, and certainly comment on how you think it was received?
I think it was offered in, if you'll pardon the expression, good faith. The Holy Father quoted from this 14th or 15th century text, but he didn't quote it in an approving manner. He said these were some of the things that have been said that have helped create this rift between the religions, and he was explicitly not in endorsing it. And instead, you have, I think, unfairly the phrase taken out of context, and then in the midst of our 24/7 around the world kind of media, it then ends up coming into the Muslim world as the Holy Father actually endorsing it. And of course, the irony you've got here, he's not endorsing the statement where somebody says that Muslims spreads their religion by intimidation and violence and so forth. But the reaction amongst the Muslim world is to respond violently, burning churches. There was a nun killed in Somalia, which people are thinking may be connected to this as well. So, I mean, it seems to me, as I said, I don't think the Pope meant it the way that it was interpreted, but how is it, why is it that it seems only it's the Muslims that react in a violent manner when a sentence is misinterpreted, and they act almost in the same way that they said that they were offended by the statement in the first place?
But let me just tell you, Robert, that a Reuters story, you know, a wire copy story, said that the statement appeared to endorse the beliefs in this quote. The Pope's statement appeared to endorse it. So it's not just Muslims who believe, perhaps erroneously, that the Pope was endorsing this. It's also Western reporters who say that his speech appeared to endorse it.
Well, in that case, then I would suggest that I think that the Western reporters need to read the speech a lot more closely, which is actually you can find it in English, German, and Italian at the Vatican website. That's the interpretation I think of many others who've read it didn't see it that way.
Callie, let's bounce off of something Robert said. He said that it's Muslims who really react violently to these statements against their religion. And there is certainly a history, you know, not just the death of the nun in Somalia, but also other, you know, churches, Christian churches in the Middle East are on high alert. They're under guard. This is a sensitive time for Islam. It's, you know, the period leading up to Ramadan. Should there be more attention to the Pope's statements or to the hostile reactions to those statements?
Well, I don't think it's an either or, and I think actually both things need to be looked at quite carefully. Actually, this is the second time that something controversial or considered offensive toward Muslims has happened right exactly. before Ramadan, which even those of us who know very little about the religion know that this is a high holiday. So it's doubly insulting. And I think that has to be taken into account. It also has to be taken into account when the Pope says it, because as Marcelo said, he is representing now an entire world of Catholics, and what he says has way more weight than just when he was standing up by himself being a cleric. And the fact that the Pope before him had made great strides to reach out across ecumenical lines and say, listen, we may disagree about how we all get to heaven if that's what we're trying to do, but we have some connectiveness here that we can work together in bringing all the peoples of the world together around issues that we deem important as people of faith. So I think that's important. What's really critical here about what Robert said about Muslims reacting violently is that when this kind of thing happens, it drowns out the voices of the moderates. It pushes the fringe to the center, and they get most of the attention. So it's not fair to say that Muslims react to violence. There are some Muslims reacting violently to this. And I would say that there are even those who are moderate and have made those statements and have stepped forward to say we may have a different viewpoint about how to respond to this, are then put in a very precarious position because, after all, this is now their religion being attacked and in a way that seems, as I indicated, doubly offensive. So I think we have to take all of that into consideration.
You know, some Muslims, again, very much qualifying this, some accuse the U.S. of waging holy war with our war in Iran, and that our motivation as a nation was partly based on religious fundamentalism. You see the conflicts in the Middle East between Jews and Muslims. This is one of those questions that I know no one can answer, but I'm going to ask you anyway because you're three really smart people. How can we parse out the differences between religion and geopolitics, or is it impossible? Are we always going to have this ebb and flow between the religious dialogue and what happens in terms of warfare, in terms of human rights, all of those things? Marcelo first.
Precisely because we're in such a delicate historic moment in the context of the conflict in the Middle East, that these issues take a relevance and a sensitivity that require immense diplomatic efforts, especially in terms of the leadership of all the parties involved. I think that the role of the issue of religion and its relationship to international relations is an issue that will continue to define our reality in the Middle East and beyond. And we need to figure out better ways, more diplomatic ways, really more human ways, humane ways to get along. Because what is at stake now is quite explosive, as we've seen with the previous controversy and as we see with the intensification of the conflict in the Middle East.
And Robert, you know, the phrase Islamic extremism is used often by people in power in the U.S. to describe the situation of terrorism that is affecting us specifically and the world globally. Again, you know, from your perspective, being someone who analyzes politics, are we doing a good job of parsing the differences between state-sponsored terrorism, extra-state terrorism, and religion?
No, I don't think we are. And I think part of that is because of, I think, sometimes the inability or the unwillingness of our American politicians to see the differences. But I think the other reason that's happening is that those differences are becoming a lot less distinct coming from the other side. I mean, traditionally, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, while obviously it has to do with the fact that there's a Jewish state in the midst of otherwise predominantly Muslim countries, most of that has been more of a geopolitical issue. I mean, the PLO was never really a religious organization. What you're seeing now, though, is more of a fusing of the religious aspect. In fact, you saw leaders from Hamas weighing in on this controversy involving involving the Pope. And so I think because of the Muslim awakening that seems to be going across the world, and particularly in the Middle East, many of the secular leaders are trying to figure out a way to co-opt it so it doesn't completely and totally overrun them. And that's why now the religious aspect is just, in a sense, merging into the geopolitical cauldron.
And Cal,
the paradox here in the context of our earlier discussion of the Holy Father's speech is that the main argument in the speech, if you read it in the Vatican website, is that Western secular societies need to reinfuse religion into our everyday phenomenology, into our everyday reality. That's the great paradox. This was a critique of Western secularism that ignited this controversy.
And Callie, we're constantly arguing there's, you know, just a new challenge to laws that basically affect how lawsuits can proceed if someone thinks that there are too many religious symbols in a public arena. We in the United States are still fighting over separation of church and state. You know, it seems difficult for us, you know, to really come to a consensus within this country, let alone outside of it. How do you think that affects our approach to these issues?
Well, I think what I would put under the general umbrella is that everything in the United States is shorthanded, and this is a very volatile issue that's shorthanded as well. And by that, I mean that, you know, we take big symbols and say, okay, Muslim bad, okay, Christian good, okay, oh, they're in the streets, they're weird, and, you know, we are not trying at all to connect to each other. And I think that what has to happen is that these big conversations, I understand if the Pope was really trying to start a conversation, don't do it on the public stage. Take it off the public stage. Let's have some folks doing the kind of diplomacy, the kind of understanding that, as Robert said, all of these things have come to fuse together, and really trying to tease that apart in sessions that are one-on-one dialogues, two-on-one dialogues. But those kinds of conversations that by the time you get to the public stage, if you are really trying to say what we have read the text and it's supposed to be saying, then it can be clear to us that that's where you're trying to begin to have the conversation. Right now, you're just, as one critic say, throwing gas on the fire. And then to do it right before Ramadan is just, you know, it doesn't help anybody. And we just get more fixed in our polarized states, which is, I think, exactly where we are in the United States. So many people are completely polarized about religion or anti-religion. There seems to be nothing in between. A person of faith cannot be anybody except one who believes a certain set of kinds of conservative beliefs at this point. So the public image would tell you. So we got to begin, I get, taking these kinds of conversations, I think, off the public stage.
Yeah, just to quickly follow up on that, and this also fits into the other structure where the president, in speaking in front of some conservative writers a week or so ago, talked about the fact that he thought that the United States was in the midst of a third awakening in terms of kind of a rising of religious fervor and sentiment, and so that also definitely sends its own kind of signals as well.
Well, you know, this is something that we could continue talking about, but I want to move to something lighthearted because what we've been talking about is so serious. I guess it's lighthearted. It was to the French. The French fashion world laughed at Spain's attempt to ban too skinny models. There's basically a body mass index that Spanish models have to meet, that they can't be too skinny. And the French couture world was like, mon Dieu, non. And so
I think that translates to fat chance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Callie, what do you think about that? Should we, or, you know, should nations basically say no Nicole Richies?
No, I don't think that this, you know, government should be getting into it. But I do applaud them for making a statement about their concern about what these skinny models say to young girls. And listen, this is Spain. This is the land where, you know, people are supposed to have some roundness on them. That's what all the painters were painting. So, I mean, this is crazy that we have gotten to the point now where everybody thinks that if you're not the size of Nicole Richie, that, you know, you have no value, at least in the fashion world. And by the way, some of this kinds of conversation was going on in my favorite show, Project Runway, not long ago, when the designers were asked to design for real women. And they're freaking out saying, I don't know how to draw anything for these size women. You know, it's like the regular woman walking around.
Yeah, these size meaning probably 12, you know, which is the average.
Exactly. Yeah.
So Marcelo, is this a government issue? I mean, should this? I mean, I cannot imagine the United States even ever bringing this up, as much as we fight over different things. But is, you know, it's a government issue in Spain.
Well, you know, as we were talking earlier, there are many important things that governments should be dealing with, and this is clearly not one of them. But having said that, and at the risk of sounding like a heavy, let me say that there is a problem of, you know, eating disorders. There is a problem of anorexia. There is a problem on the topic of body image among young women and girls. And, you know, there is a tremendous identification with these models. They dictate how girls see themselves, how a lot of girls view the impossibility of ever attaining these beauty ideals. And, you know, there are serious medical issues at stake. But clearly, no, the Spanish government has more important things to deal with than managing, you know, the size of their models.
So, Robert, I guess more Manchego cheese for the models?
Well, Farai, I'm of course, Farai, I'm definitely happy that you raised this weighty issue, and that we're provided here to give you the real skinny on it. I think the fact is, if there is actually a slightly serious aspect to this, and it dovetails with what Marcelo just pointed out, is that, you know, in the United States, you know, we have a serious problem, you know, on the other end of it, complete and total obesity. I think you've got this really bizarre spectrum where advertising and modeling is showing you this really unusual body type of these ultra skinny people. Meanwhile, the food companies and other advertising is pushing all this food that is completely and totally fatty. So, I mean, I think if there is any kind of a governmental role in any of these, it's to try and send signals of what is nutritious, eating nutritiously and eating in a healthy manner.
Gotta and I think start the middle ground. I'm going to have to cut you off, sure. Robert, you know, and go out and run a couple of miles. Robert George, editorial writer, New York Post. Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor at New York University, and Callie Crossley of Beat the Press in Boston.
I ain't heavy,
thank
I'm just
you.
A brother.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.